because I realized I don't want to be like Buffett. Buffett was so obsessed with investing that he basically neglected his kids. And today, he has the regret that when he was younger, he did not spend time with his kids because they grew up.
Thank you for coming on the podcast, man. I've read Soul in the Game, was really inspired. The title immediately hooked me. And it was a book that I'd been putting off reading for quite some time. And then I dove in, and I was, what I loved about the book was that it was like a journal entry, and it was journal entries with wisdom. And I find that when people write journal entries, it often doesn't hit me at some point. It doesn't, like, I feel like it's too self-centered. And in this case, it wasn't. And I found that fascinating. So I thought you wrote an incredible book. I'm really grateful for it. And I'm excited to talk about some of the ideas and you in this conversation.
Well, Danny, thank you very much. I'm looking forward to our conversation. Thank you.
So one idea that really hit me from the book was about creativity. And you have a quote here saying, creativity is a thread that runs throughout the whole book. I found that creativity is a secret sauce that makes life more meaningful. It's what draws me out of bed every morning. When did you discover this love for creativity?
I think I discovered that love when I started writing. Because I would argue before I started writing, I don't think I've done anything creative. Because unlike my father, you see his paintings behind me. I can't paint. I loved to listen to classical music, but I can't play an instrument. So, but I think I discovered, you know, when I started writing, I was blown away by the power of creativity. Here's why. You sit down to write, and then during your writing process, there's this incredible chemistry between your conscious and subconscious mind happens, this dance. And then when you're done writing, you start reading what you wrote, and you are surprised of what you wrote as the people who are reading it. And that part absolutely blows me away. And also, like, if you go through life without doing anything creative, you're basically, I would argue, going through life without experiencing taking risks. Like, when I sit down to write, I have these two conflicting emotions. On the one side, I have the curiosity of what I'm going to learn by the time I finish writing it, curiosity of how it's going to look. But at the same time, there is this fear, and the fear is that I won't be able to get it done. I won't be able to communicate my ideas. And by the way, I've been writing for almost 20 years, and that fear is still there. I mean, because of repetition, I kind of have more confidence that I overcome it, but it's still there every single time. So that's why creativity to me is so important, because I think that's what charges up my juices every single day. Now, my day job, in addition to writing, I invest. And I would argue there is so much creativity in investing. There is so much learning. There are so many ways to, creative ways to look at what one company and to see what other people don't. So, but creativity to me is incredibly, incredibly important.
Why is that fear still there?
Because that's a great question. Because you don't know the answer. So, okay. In the book, I talk about the story of my brother, my son, and I being in Venice. And we went to Murano, which is a little island in Venice. And in Murano, they're famous for making kind of things out of glass. You know, there's a lot of glass factories. And we go to this glass factory, and there is a guy who basically takes out a bulb of glass and put triceps into it. In a matter of 30 seconds, he turns this kind of ball of glass into a horse. And we were blown away by that. And then my son and I spent time discussing, was that an art or was it a craft? You know, and, you know, in the art, you have a lot of creativity. In craft, it's a pre-programmed automatic. It's where there's very little creativity, and so just process. You know exactly how, which steps to make. Now, and as my brother and I were discussing it, we walk in on the streets of Murano and see same horses in every single, shop. And then we realized that maybe we should ask a different question. The question is, at the time when this guy was making this horse, how much art was present? How much craft was present in that act? And here's the interesting part. I would argue when he was making this horse for the first 100 times, it was mostly art and very little craft. But 20 years later, his, you know, millionth horse, there is absolutely zero art in all craft. Why? Because he knows exactly how it's going to look when it's done.
Wow.
You know, okay. So it's when that uncertainty is gone. Okay. It's like if you make eggs at home, okay, I would argue just plain sunny side up eggs, there is very little creativity there, right? I mean, after a while, right? Because you know exactly how they're going to look like, exactly how they're going to taste. Now, if you start making new things and start adding more complex things, now, like you start adding more ingredients, the final product, there is going to be a lot more creativity in this, right? And curiosity. And also fear that you'll screw it up. Obviously, the stakes are very low. But, anyway, so that's why that fear exists, because you don't know exactly how it's going to look like. And we humans are programmed to be afraid of failure in general.
So when Michael Jordan is playing basketball, when he was, mm-hmm. was that art or craft? Or the right question is, what percentage of art and craft was that for him at his peak?
I think there was at the end, when you watched them, you saw a lot of art. Mm. Okay. However, he put so much work into it through mindful practice that he turned it into a craft. Meaning that when he made a shot and he practiced it so much that there was a very little chance at that point. And because he knew exactly how it's going to look and, you know, how the ball is going to fly into the basket. So I would argue, if for an observer, it looked like a complete art. For Michael Jordan, at that point, was probably mostly craft.
Wow, that's a fascinating thing to think about. And also that perhaps that one particular shot was craft, but the virtue of the entire game was art. And that balance, because you can never know the outcome of a game. So that balance of art and craft and having both in a single venue creates something special.
I think it's true. And you can also argue that you can also look at the process and you can say the process of not the process of his training. How did he try to improve it all the time by adding art to it? To make his, you know, when he practiced it, to make it a better practice than for, you know, what it would be for other people. Did he look at it from first principles perspective and said, okay, this is what everybody else is doing, but for me, this is, you know, this is how I need to practice to become better. So, again, I have to be honest. I live in Denver and we have Nuggets here, and I watched more Nuggets game over last season. You know, when they went into finals in the previous 20 years. So when it comes to basketball, my knowledge thins out very, very quickly.
It's an interesting thing to think about. I mean, taking it back perhaps to things you're more familiar with, your writing, in what ways is it an art and what ways is it a craft?
Well, I think the more I write, the the better my writing skills become, the kind of the art, the craft part of it, right? The better becomes my my vocabulary increases. I start reusing tricks, you know, from one essay to another. Also, I would argue when I read not just as a writer, not just as a reader, but also as a writer, because I started looking, you know, for tricks that other people are using. But when I write about investing, for the most part, to me, I would argue it's probably 80% craft, 20% art. When I write, and this is why I started writing about topics outside of investing, because when it's a, when there is so much craft in it, it just, it's, you know, it's a, to me, it becomes boring. So this is why I started, you know, writing about topics that were new to me, where the mixture of art and craft was very different. And so this is why I wrote this book, because this book does not have a single investment chapter, right? It's all, it's, I talk about composers, Klanya, philosophy, you know, parenting. So I think it's very important for us. And this is, I think this is very important. When you go through life, we can become very good at something. A lot of times what happens, kind of the ratio of art and craft tilts a lot towards craft. Mm. And there's very little art left. And this is where we lose interest. Okay. And this is important to, this is why it's important to kind of stretch the boundaries of what you do, and either venture into doing new things or trying different avenues, maybe in the same profession. So for me, expanding into new topics that, you know, outside of investing, that was my way to add more art to my writing.
It's so fascinating that you say this, because you've also said that when you love what you do, your work stops being work and becomes a craft. And no matter what it is, you do it with pride, love, and care.
Yes.
It's fascinating. I mean, that speaks to, like, that you can find joy and beauty in having a craft, because it's almost like a place of home. But then there is the art piece too, which keeps it fresh. So it's like having that balance is an important mix. But craft sometimes feels so, it feels like home, right?
Yeah, no, it's a, when you think of craftsman, like when you think somebody, when you think of a artisan, somebody who's doing something with their hands, right? In the talk, in the book, I talk about Jiro, there was a famous movie, Jiro Dreams of Sushi. I think about that guy thinking about how to improve his sushi. He's been making sushi for 70 years. He's still thinking about how to make the sushi just a little bit better. Like, there was a story there where he realized if he massages octopus for 45 minutes instead of 15, it brings out extra taste. I mean, just think about this, right? That's a complete love for what he does.
Yeah, you become one with the act when it becomes a craft, yes. Which is a beautiful, beautiful thing.
It becomes your identity. It becomes your identity, basically.
Yeah, and in that you could find boredom, but also you could find yourself. Which is
no, but I mean, I would argue any activity. If Jiro just was making California rolls all his life, he would get bored out of his mind, right? So this is why he kept making different sushi and kept improving the rice, kept improving, trying different type of sushi, etc. So I think at some point you may hit a limit of you squeeze. All, by the way, and this is success. When you completely figured out the formula of how to create something perfect, you squeezed art completely out of it. And that's absolutely fine. Just move on to something else.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of people are listening to this right now might be in the spot of not having a creative act and listening to this as a way to understand how did you come to understand writing? How did you stumble upon it? And how would you recommend someone else find their own creativity?
I stumbled into writing completely by accident. In 2004. So let me just tell you a little bit about myself so the listeners could understand. So I have a undergraduate degree in finance. I have a graduate degree in finance. I'm a CFA, which is kind of a advanced, another advanced degree in fine, you know, in investing in my industry. And so in 2004, I was 31 years old. And at that point, I've been studying for so long that when I kind of stopped studying, I started to get bored. And then I saw that the street.com was looking for writers. And what was great about that, they were paying absolutely nothing, which was great because if they were paying something, I would never apply. I would never apply for the job because I never wrote anything in my life. I had zero experience. But if they paid, since they paid nothing, I could not really fail. Mm. So I started writing and I really, really liked it. And what I also found, people liked it too. So I got a lot of, you know, when you write articles, so I started writing articles and I would get good feedback from readers. And that feedback would motivate me to go back and write more and more. So that feedback was very, very important. And then, also there is this concept, fake it till you make it. And I always felt like I was faking till I make, you know, I always had this kind of this attitude. I did not realize that at the time because maybe a year and a half after writing, for the street.com, I sent an essay to Financial Times and said, I would like to write for you. Financial Times, it's like one of the most prestigious newspapers in the world, like, you know, right next to Wall Street Journal. And I had the audacity after writing just for a year, year and a half, to asking them if they could write for them. And they said, sure. So when you fake it till you make it, it doesn't mean that you're trying to deceive others. No, that's not what it means. You are trying to deceive yourself that you deserve to be doing what you are not, what you don't think you deserve to be doing yet. So after I started writing for this for Financial Times, I 6 months later, I contacted John Wiley and Sons. I said, listen, I have an idea for this book. Again, who am I to write a book? And they said, okay. And this is kind of the story of my life. Now, the longer I've been writing and the older I got, the more self-awareness I had. And I started to look at how I was writing. So I created a lot of good habits. Let me explain what I do. So I get up about 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning every day. My laptop and my headphones are waiting in the chair next to me. I get a cup of coffee, put my headphones on, you know, hit play for classical music playlist, and I start writing. And I do this every single day, almost without exceptions. Maybe when I travel, I don't do this. You know, but basically almost every single day. So I basically write for about 700 hours a year.
Wow.
Now, if you do this, if you do something 2 hours a day, almost every day a year, you can't help but to get better. Okay? And that's basically kind of the you know, how I started writing. Now, when you write for a while, it changes you. Okay, let me explain what happens. I had a conversation almost verbatim. I had it with a friend of mine. He has an investment business like I do. And he says, Vitaly, I would like to write one article a week. I said, listen, to write one article a week, you need to write every day. I can't guarantee that you're going to write an article a week or two articles every 2 weeks, but you're going to write a lot more articles if you write once a week. Okay, I guarantee you that. He said, but you know what, Vitaly? I don't have 50 articles to write. I don't have 50 ideas to write. And I said, you're right and wrong at the same time. So I write roughly about 40, 50 articles a year. However, if you ask me what are going to be 50 articles I'm going to write for the next 4 months, I have no idea. But here's what happens. When you write every single day, your brain you get a writer's brain. A writer's brain starts looking at the world through different lens. You start looking for ideas. You start looking at the world differently. And things you did that you would not have paid attention before, you start paying attention to them. You start noticing things you did not notice before. And you're going to have over, you know, you're going to be listening to podcasts and the host will say something interesting. You think, okay, you know what? That's a writing prompt for tomorrow. So this is how you get 50 ideas a year. But he says, Vitaly, you know what? I want to just write about investing. But it's a true story. This is not, true story. He said, I only want to write about investing because, you know, you write about other topics, not interesting to me. I said, you know what? You're absolutely right, except that's what you say today. When you start writing for a while, your writer's brain will have a mind of its own. And suddenly you'll be writing about bonsai trees or chess or whatever other topics that you never thought you would write, you know, before. And this is why I would argue that anybody should try to write every day start with 5 minutes a day, but just create space. And when I say space, I mean, I'm talking about temporal and physical space, meaning dedicate, find a time in the day where you're going to say, I'm going to write. For me, I do it in the morning because I have the most amount of energy. I'm a morning person. I can link it to waking up. My family is still asleep at 5 a.m, so I have that space. You know, I have also freedom from my wife and my children for those 2 hours, which is fine. But find that temporal space, but also find a physical space. Where are you going to write? And just start doing 5 minutes a day and then increase it. And my advice would be write a journal. Now, it's a hypocritical advice because I don't write a journal. Now, let me explain why. I have a good excuse. I tried to do journal for a month. And Penn Jillette from Penn and Teller, I listened to his interview with Tim Ferriss, and he was saying that he had a journal for last 40, 50 years. No, for maybe 30-something years of his wow. life. And his biggest regret in his life that he did not start early.
Wow.
And he wakes up every morning, and the first thing he does, he looks what he wrote on this day 1 year ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years
wow.
ago. And that is a very interesting kind of, it's almost looking, you know, like when you pull up your iPhone and it tells you this, you know, this day last year, right? And I think that is an incredible idea. The reason I don't do this it's a very specific to me. When I did it, my brain was confused. Was I writing my in the morning essay or was I doing a journal? Okay. But since I write every day, it doesn't matter. But if you don't have anything, if you don't think you have anything to write every day, just start journaling your thoughts about what you read, what happened to you yesterday, whatever.
So it's interesting. You said part of the reason why you continued writing was one, because you liked it, and two, because other people liked it as well.
Yes.
So how does somebody find that thing that they like doing and other people like them doing if they don't feel like they have it right now and they don't feel like it's writing?
I think the first thing you want to do, you want to find what you like doing first.
Okay.
So this is a good question. So for writing, it's a good question. I'm not sure if I continued writing if I didn't get the positive feedback.
Mm-hmm.
I may or may not have. I don't know. I honestly don't know the answer to this. And I'm kind of thinking, do you need this to have this positive feedback from others, or your own feedback is enough? In other words, you can paint and you enjoy in painting even if nobody else likes it. I mean, I think about Van Gogh. I think he only sold one painting, or either one or no paintings, you know, in his
wow.
life. And he became famous, you know, basically after his death. Okay. I would argue that Stoics would say you probably don't want to link your happiness to admirations of others. It is much easier. I mean, it's, I would argue, well, this is tricky. This actually, it's a, such a, Danny, it's such a great question. I guess you could argue there was some luck in my case because I received the positive, you know, there was that, that positive feedback loop helped me, gave me the confidence to keep coming back and writing, right? But if you think about writing, it is something like especially write for a website, you know, is that you're communicating your ideas to others. Painting, for instance, you can argue that is actually could be, you know, a solitary exercise that you paint for yourself. You paint because you enjoy the process. So today, I would argue my best articles are not the ones that people love, but the ones that I love.
Mm.
So I'll give you an example. There was a chapter in my book, the one that probably nobody cares about. And actually the one that you and I discussed, Art and Craft chapter, I don't think anybody cared about this chapter. Like, I don't think I got a single email about this chapter. I got emails about all other chapters, but not this one.
Go figure.
And this is, to me, the dearest chapter to me, by far. So today when I write, I am just trying to please one person, myself. When I started writing, it was helpful to me that I got that positive feedback. And maybe the reason for that because it was such a new endeavor for me. I knew, like, I'd never written anything before. So if you get positive feedback, that's great. But I would argue that even if you don't, just keep going.
Yeah, I would agree. And it was funny. Joe Rogan was asked, would you still do this podcast if it wasn't well received? And he also, similar to you, was like kind of struggling to answer that question or to think about it because he realized, and I do agree with the notion of like, you should do things for yourself, but we are communal beings. And if mm-hmm. people are saying you're doing something well, that feels good. And that is a sign that you're on some sort of right path.
It is. The only problem is that, and this is very, like, this is the reason that I have a hesitation about this, is that if you start doing things that other people like, yeah. you start doing things for likes and clicks.
Yes.
And you start losing your internal compass. And then it changes. At the end of the day, you're just going to start producing junk.
Yes.
So this is why I'm very careful about this, because this is why you have this. This is why the harshest critic of my writing is myself.
Mm.
And I will not publish anything I don't like, anything that doesn't meet my high standard.
How do you determine that standard?
It's just something, you know, as a creator, I learned when I like my writing, when I don't. I mean, it's in the beginning, you don't know. Okay. But after you've been doing it for a while, you become an expert in your field and you're able to judge yourself. Did I communicate my thought clearly? Did I find an interesting story to communicate? You know, did I find an interesting venue or story to bring my idea to life? But I think it comes with experience.
When you look back at the earliest articles that you created, would you have published those or not today?
It's kind of interesting. I was working on an article. And I was referring to another article I wrote literally 13 years ago, 12 years ago. And I went back and read the article and realized today I would not have published that article. Wow. But that's a very good thing.
Yes.
That means I have improved as a writer but that's what you want to see, right? You want to keep improving.
And do you know at what point that changed? Meaning, at what point, how many years ago, would you have said, I would publish this today? Is it the articles you wrote 2 years ago? Is it the articles you wrote 4, 6, 8, 10?
It's hard to say. It's very hard to say because there are some articles I wrote even 10 years ago that I would not change mm-hmm. a word. And there are some in that article I read, I'm like, no, it's not. It's too choppy. Mm-hmm. There is too much repetition, etc. So I think one thing writing does for you, it gives you mindfulness and self-awareness. Mm. And again, we keep talking about writing because I think it's the biggest gift I received in this life. Like right on par with having kids.
Wow.
Because it added probably 20 IQ points to me, and I needed them desperately. What the self-awareness is that when you can look at your, it basically allows you to kind of as an outsider to look at your own process, to look at your own thoughts, and notice things that you would not have noticed otherwise. And that's, you know, and I think writing does that. You know, writing, you know, I'm not sure it does it right away, but over time I got that.
It's meditative because you see yourself in third person.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. And
especially the way I write, because I always write, like my writing is a, you know, there's a, there are two types of writers. There's kind of Al Pacino writers and John Wayne writers. Okay, let me explain what I mean. You know, Al Pacino has this incredible range. He can play, he can do comedy, he can do drama, he can do King Lear. Okay? And so there are some writers like that. They are kind of professional writers. They can write about anything, any voice, etc. I am not that kind of writer. Then there is an actor like John Wayne. John Wayne has not acted a day in his life. He always played John Wayne, right? And that's how I write. I can only, like, when you read my writing, you know I wrote it because you hear that voice. You hear the voice. So that is my writing. It's very self-reflective.
Yeah.
So
how come your writing like that doesn't come across as boastful? Whereas sometimes I feel that when people write in that style of just talking about themselves, it does. What's going on there?
Because I'm afraid, because I'm afraid it's going to come out boastful. So there is always self-deprecation, but I'm always conscious of that. I mean, I guess in honesty, I'm always conscious of that. And that's why I hopefully doesn't.
Yeah, it definitely doesn't. You know, I think one of the central questions that we all have to consider is how much are we going to value someone else's voice and versus how much are we going to value our own? And what it seems like writing has done for you in many respects is it has allowed you to tap into your own voice in a greater and greater way. And I noticed you passed this along to your children as well. And I mean, I had tears in my eyes when I read that you wrote to your children or you told your children, don't try to please us in your career choice. The only person you want to please is yourself. We'll support whatever choice you make. We just want you to be happy. And if you are happy, we'll be happy with you. It's beautiful.
You know, I thank you. When I look at my kids, what I want for them, I just really want them to be happy. I want them to be strong people that can get through obstacles that life will throw at them. And I want them to be happy. Now, if they decide to go in investing, I won't object. But if my daughter decides she wants to be a psychologist, or my son decides he wants to be a doctor, he doesn't, but if he did, I would have no problem with that. I just really just want them to be happy, not to please me, but to find themselves and to be happy. And if they're happy, I'll be happy.
Did that come about because your dad didn't understand? You said about your dad, he grew up in a world where the government owned almost all private property. He had thought investing was a legalized form of gambling with other people's money. He could not believe that I could actually have a career in this investing thing. For a long time, he insisted that I go into a real business, something tangible, like opening up a bagel store or a donut shop.
Yeah. No, I think my father wanted me to be happy. The only reason he was afraid of me going into invest in it because he didn't think it was real. Like, you know, like if you, like, let's say, okay, well, let me give an example. So if the same way my father would have the same concern if I was a professional gambler.
Yeah.
Right? Because you don't know if that person is going to be successful or not. And that's how my father looked at investing. And I promise you, what I do is so different from gambling, from professional gambling. But my father, because he grew up in the Soviet Union, he had no concept of investing. And it's only until he edited my first book, when he edited into Russian, my first book, Active Value Investing, that he realized, actually, this is not gambling. This is a real profession, I guess. My father wanted me to be happy. He just wanted me to not to be broke at some point in time and, be destitute because I lost all my money, doing legalized gambling. That's what he thought.
This, when you said this and you wrote this, it was so heart. It filled my heart because my dad looks at the podcast and is like, what is this? This is gambling with your life. Get a real job. What's wrong with you? And I was like, wow, in a world, if I went into investing, he'd be so happy that I got a real job that society said, but that's just his framing of the world. What would you say to me to help show my dad that no, podcasting is a real job, or that this actually could be a career or something longer term than how he currently views it?
Well, I think number one, I think you would probably want your father to watch your podcasts and see how good they are.
Thank you.
That's number one. Okay. Number one. Number two, I mean, you could show him that there are, successful podcasters and you can show him how the income statement looks like, if you have so many listens and stuff. I think it's the issue, like my father thinking of investing as gambling, your father thinking of podcasting as not a profession. It's just, it's new to our parents. I'm sure if my son came to me and said he wants to go into profession and know very little about, I would have the same concern. I would tell him, I would support you and give it your best shot.
That's wonderful. I mean, the way you write about your children is really so beautiful. And one thing on regrets was, it hit me today about you talking about regrets and how the not making an introduction in that moment, not connecting with people, like how much it stays with you. The situation you describe in the book is about the water park and your daughter going down the slide and your son having difficulty or not wanting to go down, and it stays with him a year, right? Or more?
Yeah, a couple of years, at least.
So could you tell that story? It's so beautiful how you handled it as well.
Yeah, so so my son, he's 22. I forget, at the time he was maybe 15, and my daughter is 3 years younger, so she's 12. My son is, imagine it's a boy-girl kind of dynamics, right? Older brother, younger sister. Except my son, because he had asthma when he was little, he still has asthma, it made him, it's actually had an impact on him. He was scared of things. Okay, so he was a very timid boy. My daughter Hannah was not afraid of anything. And this is this whole rivalry started when it took me, we live in Denver, so we go skiing. I had to, for my son to go on a very easiest called bunny slope, it took me like a week of begging. Okay. My daughter, who was at the time 3 years younger than him, just went the first time she went down the hill, she saw a little bump. She actually turned towards the bump and she went on the bump. And when I asked her about this, she's like, yeah, because I wanted him to make him feel bad. But anyway, we went to water park, and maybe this was, maybe he was 13 years old or something. And there was this slide that looks very scary. You go to the top of it and you go down, and it's a scary slide. And they went up, they both of them went up. She went down and he backed out. And so maybe 2 or 3 years later, went to San Francisco. And it was, you know, San Francisco Bay, even in summertime, it's still cold. And it was, I think it was in the fall, so it wasn't even that warm. And I offered my son, I said, listen, I'll give you $50. I forget how much it was, maybe $50, if you swim from here to that ship. And
how far was the ship out?
Maybe, I don't know, 200 feet or 300 feet. You know, it's a distance, but it's cold. It's not even about the distance, it's about the cold. And my daughter automatically says, Dad, I'll do it for free. And my son said, I'll do it. And then they both did it, and it was very cold. And when I asked him later why he did it, he said, well, you know, the time when she went down the slide, I had that regret that she did it and I didn't. And I didn't want to have the same regret again. So it's kind of interesting how that little regret stayed with him. So they have this rivalry till this day, and you know, she's now almost 18 and he's 22. So
what is it about that regret that stays with people? Because people often, I felt this, there was a girl that I wanted to get her number. She was at the grocery store and I was like, oh, I really should have got her number. I saw her 2 days later and asked for her number. And I was like, I feel so much better now by virtue of just me making the ask. Like, what is that?
I was watching a documentary about Sylvester Stallone on Netflix, which, by the way, I highly recommend. And there was a story there about he basically, in his early years, he had a hard time getting an acting job. And he realized that the only way he's going to be able to become an actor if he writes his own script. So he wrote a script for the Rocky. And at the time he was completely broke. And he was offered $250,000. Remember, this is like 1980 or something, like early
80s. $250,000?
Wow. Yes, for the script. But for him not to play the main role. He said no. And I think he got up to $500,000 and he still said no. And his explanation was, he did not want to have regret in his life that he did not take the chance. And, you know, yes, he said at some point I would spend that $500,000, but I would still have that regret. And I think this is kind of, in our life, I think what we try to do, we're trying to do regret minimization. And I think it drives us a lot. So I think it's a driving force for all of us.
Have you put anything in place to help yourself with dealing with those situations that you might regret today?
I do. One of my biggest fears in life is that at one day, I'll look back at my life and I'll see that I haven't spent enough time with my kids. Now, like, my day job is investing. I absolutely love what I do. And the problem is that when you love what you do, when you love what you do, it becomes an addiction. And I can spend 15 hours a day working, looking, you know, reading companies' calls or whatever, reading 10Ks. But I read a book about Warren Buffett, The Snowball, which is a basically authorized biography of Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett gave access to Alice Schroeder to all his files, all his friends. And when I read this book, after reading this book, I realized, despite being a value investor, despite Warren Buffett being my role model on many levels, when it comes to parenting, he was my anti-hero. because I realized I don't want to be like Buffett. Buffett was so obsessed with investing that he basically neglected his kids. Mm. And today, he has the regret that when he was younger, he did not spend time with his kids because they grew up. So I have this, you know, the Stoics provide many different ways, you know, many different techniques for this. One of them is negative visualization. Like my nightmare is that, you know, a person who, you know, who doesn't have a deep connection with my kids, a person who spends very little time with my kids. So I visualize the person and I don't want to be him. So I'll tell you, a lot of times I basically kind of put this automatic subroutines, I would argue. Like I drive my kid, you know, until this year, actually, I was driving my kids to school all, you know, almost every day. The only reason this year I'm not driving them as much because my oldest daughter now is driving my youngest to school. But I had this, and I reframed it that I reframed it. I used to look at, driving my kids to school as a chore. But then I reframed it because I realized I only have so many times that I'll be able to drive them to school. Okay. And once I realized that, let's say like my, you know, like until last, you know, so until last year, I realized that this year I won't be driving my daughter who's a senior to school. I realized I only have 200 days. So every time I don't drive, that's one less day I have a chance to drive her. And so what also happened, because I realized how finite that is, when I was in the car with them, I made sure that I was present. I wasn't talking on the phone to my friends or to my clients. We listened to music. We listened, you know, we talked. And that was very, very important to me. So those kind of the tricks I used to basically be present with my kids, to kind of reduce this kind of, to minimize my regret, my future regret.
When you think about that time that you weren't present, let's say you were on the phone.
Yeah.
What could someone have said to you in that moment to help you be more present?
Probably very little. I think the problem is, we have to come to things on our own. For me, like when I read Buffett's, you know, biography, honest to God, this is a 500, 600 page book. I don't remember a single story other than that.
Wow.
Out of this whole book, because I read it at the right time. If I read it a year earlier or a year later, it may not have clicked with me. So it has to come to us at the right time. I'll give you one example. So this is I turned 50 this year. And on my 50th birthday, I had friends over. And this friend came who is 10 years older than me. And I looked at this friend, and he's a good friend of mine, but I haven't seen him in a while. And he looked like he swallowed a watermelon. He had this, like, you know, he just, you know, he's 10 years older than me. You know, he's the same complexion, but as his metabolism slowed down, he just gained weight and he just looked like he was nursing a watermelon. And I looked at it and realized, this is me 10 years from now. And at that point, I realized I need to figure out a way to change that, to reverse that. 4 days later, I'm at a conference and a friend of mine tells me about how she and her other friends lost a whole bunch of weight. And she tells me about this diet. And if we had this conversation 10 days before, I probably would have just ignored it. But we had the conversation at the right time, when I was just, I've been obsessed about, you know, being turning 50, about getting older, metabolism slowed down. So I 2 days later, next Monday, I went on this diet. And it became my healthy lifestyle. I don't even call it a diet anymore. And since then, I lost 17 pounds.
Wow.
And kept it off.
Very nice.
In fact, I have the lowest weight now than I ever had of last 30
wow.
years.
Wow.
So So I think, you know, the message has to come to us at the right time.
My friend Talia said yesterday to me, the truth has a timeline. And I was like, that is so true, right? Like there was a timeline for you to get in better shape. What's that been like? What's that been like now that you're in the best shape of your life or at the lowest weight of your life? How has that affected your life in unexpected ways?
Well, so what I did, I kind of turned it into my identity. I'm a person who is healthy. I'm a person, and if you're a healthy person, when somebody brings you French fries, you don't eat French fries because a person who is healthy does not eat French fries. Also, a healthy person works out. You know, it becomes a flywheel. It turns into a flywheel. And what's really blew me away, how easy it was for me to lose weight. It was like once I got into this mindset, it was incredibly easy. And I didn't take any, there was nothing wrong with it, but I didn't take any weight loss medicine, etc. Just through healthy eating, you know, smaller portions, a lot of fruits, and a lot of vegetables, protein, you know, low carbs. That was it. And it was the easiest thing I ever did in my life.
Wow. Well, that's pretty incredible. I think, you know what? I think the marketing of weight loss, the marketing of making money, the marketing of specific things makes us believe that it has to be difficult. But what if it was the easiest thing in the world?
What's truly incredible is that, I mean, we can switch to this, you know, to this topic of weight loss a little bit, because I think it really blew me away how easy it is. And let me tell you what the diet is. It's just so simple. So for the first 20 days, I was just creating a new habit. Okay. And the habit was basically I would eat 4 ounces of, you know, vegetables and 6 ounces of vegetables, 4 ounces protein. No carbs, no sweets. That was it. Just some fruits. And if you do this for 20 days, it slowly becomes your habit. And what you also realize that 4 ounces of protein is basically more or less what we need to eat. Like I would, it's quite amazing that I would go to a steakhouse and order an 8 ounce steak, cut it in half, take that, put the other half in the doggy bag and eat the first half slowly. And I was full, like really full. Like the shock to me was that, and then I looked it up, our portion sizes in the United States basically increased by 50% or more over the last 30 or 40 years. Wow. What used to be, what's now a kid's burger at McDonald's used to be a normal burger. Just think about this. Anyway, I've been thinking a lot about diet, and here's what I realized. Diet is a very tricky thing, because who am I to dispense dieting advice? And nobody should listen to me about this. However, there are certain truths about it, okay? And I'm not saying, you know, and the truth is this. If you eat less processed food, you'll be healthier. If you eat more vegetables, you'll be healthier. If you eat smaller portions, you consume fewer calories. So, and if you keep doing those things, then you'll be healthier. That's it. Do you want to eat carbs? Don't eat carbs. Whatever. Just no, like less processed food. You know, more whole foods. By the way, I finally understood what whole foods means. You know, it took me a long time to figure out what whole foods means, basically. Yes.
What did you find out? What does whole foods mean?
It's basically anything that doesn't look like it's been created in a lab. You know, it's
anything that wasn't created in the last 100 years is what.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. Anything that goes better within days of you buying it probably is whole food. anything can, you know, the Twinkie is probably, you know, Twinkie that can survive for centuries is probably the extreme of what non-whole foods mean.
Yeah. And yeah. You say, like, who am I to be talking about health advice? But I think the truth is that you are somebody who has lost weight and is in the best shape of their life in 30 years. And that is the exact reason why it's necessary for you to do it. Because a lot of times, people who are in the best shape of unattainable Arnold Schwarzenegger type status, it's like, okay, but I'm never going to be Arnold Schwarzenegger. So why should I take advice from him? Whereas, like, you are somebody who's a normal person on their health journey and has had success. I think there's more need for people like you to put out.
Let me tell you. So I approached it from a very scientific perspective in this way. On the very first day of my diet, I went to my doctor and took a blood test. And my cholesterol numbers, I'm glad my insurance company probably not watching this podcast. Okay. But my cholesterol numbers were basically 3 or 4 times the norm. Wow. On the bad side. On the day 21st, I went to the doctor again and did the same blood test. My cholesterol numbers went from horrible to great.
Wow.
Like literally, one number is my triglycerides went from 330 or something to 120. Like something like this. So just from insane to great.
Wow.
And you know what? Here's the thing. Okay. So when we think about weight loss, we think about how we look. But I think to me, this is so much more than that. It's really about how we feel. It's really, so the Peter Attia talks about this. When we think about our health, we think about longevity. Oh, I want to live until I'm 100. I think and Peter Attia explains it. That's not how you want to look at this. It's when you are 80, you want to be able to do most things you're doing when you're 60. Okay, and not be suffering in aches and be able to enjoy your grandkids and be able to travel is to have just a life that doesn't have pain and have a normal life. So this is why I think having a healthy lifestyle is so important. It's not just about losing weight. Weight is just one of the measurable metrics, but it's also just having a lot more energy. Having a better sleep. My sleep has improved tremendously. And you know how important sleep is to your health. Anyways, so it's incredible.
It's not about how long you live. It's about how you feel in the years that you do live. And so you are really making the most out of that. And you're an inspiration from that perspective. You had something on half-binary decisions that I've never heard of a half-binary decision before, but I love the phrasing of it. And when we talk about bad habits, you said there are two ways to give up bad habits. First, change your environment. And second, make a half binary decision. What is that?
Yeah. Well, so, okay. So there's two parts to it. So number one, imagine you're a person who kind of, for the most part, doesn't eat desserts. Okay. So you go to the restaurant and your girlfriend or your wife or whatever orders dessert. At this point, you have to make a decision. Am I going to have dessert or not? Now, that decision consumes energy, the willpower. Now, then let me ask you this question. Like, you don't look like a person who smoke, right? You don't smoke, right? Okay, if I give you a cigarette, so then here's a cigarette. How much energy is it going to consume for you to say no?
Zero energy.
Because you're the person who doesn't smoke, right? So it's non-decision, right? Is it? Mm. So if you become a person who says, I don't need desserts, then it's really not a decision. Like once a month, I take my kids on the way to school and I get them donuts. And without an exception, I don't get a donut for myself. I get it for them. I don't get a donut for myself. Even though right there, I'm in the donut shop because I'm the person who doesn't eat desserts or sugar, whatever. Right? So it consumes zero energy, none. Because I'm the person who doesn't deserve. So if it becomes part of your identity that you are the person who, and then you just fill in the blank, then what it does, it removes a lot of decisions that consume energy, that consume willpower, and suddenly you can get rid of a lot of habits this way. Now, let me give you the second part to this. I read and I think this is true, that a lot of American soldiers in Vietnam became addicted to cocaine or whatever, some other drug. But when they came to the United States, a lot of them completely kicked off that addiction because that addiction was the main base. Like when they were in Vietnam, they had a certain type of lifestyle. I mean, probably looking at bullets and a lot of blood, you know, was conducive to that. And when they came to the United States, they dropped the drug addiction. So I tried this experiment on me. So I have this rule. When I leave Denver, I don't have a diet. So like donuts, no problem. Ice cream, no problem. When I travel to Europe, I don't have a diet. And here's what I find is that, first of all, the donut tastes so much better when you did not have it for months. That's number one. Number two, when I come back to Denver, it's back to my old domain, that's not an issue. Wow. So I call it 8% diet because I figure out I travel about 1 month a year, you know, between vacations, business trips, etc. So basically for 8% of my time, I can eat anything I want when I'm outside of Denver. By the way, I still make sure that I eat a lot of vegetables, etc. But a lot of things that I don't allow myself to eat in Denver, like sugar, I enjoy ice cream. I buy one scoop of ice cream and I take a taster spoon and I realize I enjoy that little one scoop of ice cream as much as it was five scoops. And I eat it with a big spoon. So anyway, those are the tricks I do.
That's wonderful. And it's so good. And on that point about like when you're actually traveling, you have a great line on abundance, which I've never considered before, which is abundance often devalues things we enjoy. There is such thing as too much of a good thing. And I was like, that is so fascinating because how many people who don't have abundance want abundance so badly, but then when they get it, they might say to themselves, oh, it was better when I just wanted to get the thing that I wanted because the abundance makes it such that you kind of take it for granted in some way.
Yeah, no, I immigrated to the United States from Russia. And in Russia, like when buying an ice cream was a big deal. It was plenty of ice cream, etc. But we didn't eat it every day. It was something you ate. It was a luxury. So when we came to the United States, I realized you can buy a five-gallon kind of drum of ice cream. Or maybe, I don't know, maybe it's a gallon drum of ice cream. But this was huge. And I tell you, that was so incredible. So we came to the United States for $5, we get this huge drum of ice cream. And the first day, it was great. The second day, it was phenomenal. Then on day 10, it kind of started to lose the taste. And then 3 months later, it just takes like kind of sweet ice. And I thought at first that it's just the ice cream went bad. So we bought a new drum, and the new drum did not taste as good either. And I didn't have self-awareness at the time to realize what happened. Only now I realize what happened was there is such a thing as too much of a good thing. Because it stopped, your taste buds get used to it and it stops being special. So if you want to enjoy, paradoxically, if you want to enjoy ice cream more, you want to eat less of it or less frequently. And then every single time, then you're going to enjoy it more. By the way, this applies to many things in your life. Like if you go to Starbucks every day, ask yourself a question, or maybe try it. What if I just stop going for a month? First of all, you may actually realize you're going to save hundreds of dollars. And then actually that $5 frappuccino, whatever you get in Starbucks, you're going to enjoy it so much more. So think about it. So in other words, instead of spending $500 or whatever, $150, you're going to spend five. But that experience, you're going to enjoy it a lot more than that $150 you spend on the 30 frappuccinos before.
When we remove the thing that we enjoy, it creates a fondness and an ability to appreciate it more. So
absolutely.
I love the challenge and the idea. Before I let you go, I got to talk to you about nature. We got to talk about nature. You got nature behind you. And you had this fascinating, I mean, the ideas that you have in this book are incredible and thought-provoking and really insightful. You said, maybe we should also think about how nature shapes society. And I think this is from one of your trips. You went away and you saw how living in Colorado shaped you versus living in a different place. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, how does nature shape society?
I think I was talking about, I was driving from Switzerland to France, to south of France. And if you drive through Switzerland, Switzerland is very Swiss. You know, it's very proper, very on time, very, like, I'm trying to find adjective to describe Swiss, but let me put it this way. The adjectives will not be warm. Whatever they are, they're not warm, okay? Beautiful, not warm. And then you get to France, and suddenly the mountains start looking a little bit fuzzier and warmer. And it's kind of, when you think about French people, you think about warm, and kind of, you think about a lot more warmth, love. Right?
Huh? Love.
Love. Lovers, not fighters. Yes. They think about French. Lovers, not
only
fighters.
To Americans, fighters.
Sometimes. Yeah. So, I was looking at this, and I was thinking, maybe nature does have impact on people. Mm. Like if Swiss people grew up in France and French people grew up in Swiss, the personalities might have been different because the environment is different. So I go for a walk every day. And I go for a walk not because of exercise, of a physical exercise. Because I don't really stress myself that much. Though it's probably better than just sitting in my chair all the time. But I go for the mental exercise. And also what you find is that when you are, like, think about, Danny, just look around you. Every single object around you is symmetrical. The paintings behind me is square. Every single thing around you is symmetrical, right? When you go outside in nature, nature is not symmetrical. The leaves don't look identical. Wow. They're all the different shapes. And I think it changes our thinking. If you're only sitting in the office and thinking in the office, your thoughts will go through kind of through the same tracks. If you want to change the tracks, go outside, get exposed to nature, and you're going to be, your thoughts will start going through very different tracks. And so that's why I would argue that you want to spend at least 30 minutes, so at least an hour a day outside.
If we circle back to the beginning, the office is the craft. Nature is the art.
That's right. So if you want to have more art in your life, you need to have more exposure to nature.
Wow. I mean, you are a brilliant mind, good sir. I'm so grateful for your presence on this podcast. The way you look at the world is truly a writer's mind, and you have such a gift for it. And I'm so excited to hopefully one day have you back on this podcast, continue talking about the ideas that come to your mind and your being. And I'm really grateful for it all. Before I let you go, I have to ask, a challenge of you to someone listening right now who has listened to us for the past hour and now wants to do something from the conversation that we said or something we haven't mentioned yet in the podcast. What's a challenge you can leave someone listening with?
Two challenges. I mentioned both of them. 30 days. Write 15 minutes a day. That's challenge number one. Challenge number two, if you're doing something like getting Chipotle burrito every day or going to Starbucks every day, just give it up for one month.
Mm.
And then, Okay. Before you do this, go and get your burrito if you go to Chipotle, get the burrito and try to remember the feeling and then give it up for a month and see how it's going to taste to you a month later. See if your enjoyment is going to be greater or not. So that's my challenge.
I love those challenges. Vitaly, you are an absolute treasure of a human being. You could find you at Vitaly K on Twitter or X. Soul in the Game is the book, and linked below on Amazon. Anywhere else we should send people to connect with you further?
Yeah, so we have I have a newsletter. I don't know if it's a newsletter, but it's where you can read my articles. If you go to the easiest link there is, investor.fm, like FM radio. Mm-hmm. If you go to investor.fm, you can read my articles. You can sign up to get my articles. And there is a link. There's a podcast we have there that you can listen to, which is basically, it's very different from yours. I call it Lazy Man's Podcast, because my articles are basically read to you, not by me, but someone else. Yeah.
That's wonderful. Everyone check that out. Investor.fm, link down below. Thank you so much.
And Danny, thank you so much. I mean, you are such a good host, and I can see you have a truly learner's mind. So you have such an incredibly bright future. So I'm really excited about where you're going to go.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
And tell your father not to worry. You'll be fine.
I'll send him this clip.
Absolutely.
Much love. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Danny.